Okay, we begin here on the top of Kufay Amun Aleph by the two dots. Mishnah says, Chutz mi pachot shave pruta bekeren. Once you have less than a shave pruta worth of the principal amount, you no longer have an obligation to chase the individual down and to return the money directly to him. So now we have a qualification of that by Rav Papa. Am Rav Papa, loshanu ela she'ein gzeila kayemet. That's only true when we're talking about monetary recompense for the stolen item. But if you have the physical stolen item in your hand, then we do force you to go after him and return the item. Because we worry about the fact that its value might increase over time, and therefore its value will exceed the minimum threshold of a pruta. So even though right now it's less than a pruta, it has the potential or the possibility of rising above a pruta because it's not money. And because of that, we want you to return it in order to ensure that we don't run into this problem. That's one version of Rav Papa. Igadamre, the other version of Rav Papa is Am Rav Papa, Loshna Gzela Kayemet, Veloshna She'en Gzela Kayemet, Eino Tzarich Lelecha Charav. No matter what the circumstances, whether it's money that he has to return, or whether it's an actual object that he has to return because he has the gzela in hand, he does not have to chase him down if the value of the object or the value of the money is less than a shemet pruta. The shemet yaker lo chayshinan. Obviously, in this version, we do not worry about appreciation of a value. We look at the circumstances of the situation as they are currently, and if it's less than a shemet pruta, then he doesn't have to chase him down. And so interestingly, the next case will also have something like this. But from this, it sounds like that if over time the value did increase, there would be a need to return the object. And then that might impact on the korban that you brought. If you already brought an asham for the remainder of the monies that you had returned, and now all of a sudden the piece that you have left exceeds the minimum threshold of a pruta, which requires you now to return it, do you then have to bring another korban, or does that undermine the first korban? That happens to be a machloket rishonim. It's more borne out by the next case of Rava, but it's your question, which is, if you don't worry about it possibly going up in value, that means that we don't worry about a future possibility. But if the possibility is manifest and it does go up in value, it sounds like you would have to return it and you would have to deal with it. And then what are the implications of that vis-a-vis the original return and the original korban that you brought? So Amar Rava, Gazal Shlosh Agudot. So he stole three bundles or three of anything, Bishlosh Prutot. And each one was worth a prutan. Vihuzlu. And they depreciated in value, bamdu al shtayim. And now the whole bunch, the whole three of them are only worth two prutot. Im yechzir lo shtayim, if he returned two of them, chayav lachzir lo acheret. He has to return the third item. So not only does he have to return the two, which at this point will be the majority of the two prutot, because that's two-thirds of the two prutot that you have there. So if you don't return the third item is clearly below the threshold of a prutah. Nevertheless, you do have to return it. The basic principle here of Rava is that we look at it at the zman that you stole it. Because we know that every obligation with regards to gzela is at the zman gzela. And since the zman gzela was shaveh, three prutot, therefore you have to return the items because they are shaveh, three prutot at that time. Even though currently they are worth less. Now, Tosfot over here points out, Perush, im yeshna be'en magzirota, meaning that if it's extant, the item is here, then he's got to return it. Vim lav mishalem le shave pruta kmo shehayta shave bishat gzela. And obviously, if he's lost the item, then he pays kishat gzela. Paying kishat gzela is a pruta. So that means, or in essence, what we're teaching us here is that even though by returning two out of the three items, you have been mekayim the mitzvah of hashava, you still have to return the last item because it has, we'll call it, monetary worth or replacement worth of a pruta. If you give back this item, it's worth less than a pruta and you are discharging your obligation of hashava. If you lose this item or you don't return it, you're going to owe the guy a pruta because you didn't return that last item, and that item at the time of the gzela was worth a pruta. So for that reason, you have to return the item or you have to return a pruta. But either way, you have to return this item despite the fact that it's currently below the value of a pruta. So even though, again, you've accomplished the mitzvah shavah with the other two, you still have to return the last item here. And the Gemara is going to bring a proof in a second to Rava's position from a Mishnah in Psachim. And so then the Tosafot says, what's the Chiddush of Rava at that point? Because the Mishnah itself really makes the same point that Rava's making. In the end, he says that, Hayi Rabuta Dekimol Kamar Rava Misvaro. He says that this special din that applies to three is what Rava brings misvara. Because what is written in the Mishnah, or what you would have learned from the Mishnah, is only about one item, and one item that goes up and down in value. And that you could have concluded from that Mishnah, and even Rava himself could have brought the case as being a case of one item that started out as above a pruta and now is below a pruta. Rava's chiddush, or Rava's addition to this whole sequence here, is that not only is it true when you're dealing with one item, but even when you're dealing with three items, and that last item is clearly less than a shevet pruta, and you're able to accomplish the mitzvah shavah with the other two. In a case where you only have one item, of course you have to return the item, because otherwise you haven't returned anything, you haven't done a mitzvah shavah. Rava's chiddush is that you have three items now. With two of them, you accomplish the mitzvah shavah of returning the item. Maybe then you would think that the third item does not need to be returned. That's the chiddush of Rava, that the third item still has to go back, despite your accomplishing of the mitzvah shavah with the first two items. And so now the Gemara brings a proof to what Rava is saying over here, Vatani Tuna, and our Tana says, Gazal Chametz, Varval Lava Pesach, someone who steals Chametz, and then Pesach passes by. Omer Loar Shel Chalifanecha, he can give it back to him and say, here it is, this is yours. Taima Dita Beinei, that's only because he has the Chametz in hand that he can do this. Haleta Beinei, if it wasn't in hand, Avagav Dahash Lava Monahu, even though currently it's not worth anything, it's worthless. Kaven to me, Karama Monahu, since originally at the time of the Gzela it was worth money, Bayishlume, he's gonna have to make restitution for it, he's gonna have to pay for it. Achanami, so too in our case here by Rava, Avagav Dahashta Lo Shavapruta, even though now it's not worth a Shavapruta, Kaven to me, Karava Shavapruta, Bayishlume. Again, so therefore, at the time that the Gzela happened, it was Shavapruta, that determines whether you have to return it or not. And again, vis-a-vis one item, Rava's din is not really a chiddush, because that's what the Mishnah by Psachim really says, that it's determined by the Shatah Gzela. So you have one item, it was originally worth the pruta, it's not worth the pruta now, of course you have to return it, because it replaces the need to pay a pruta. Rava's bigger chiddush is even when you have three items, that's what Tosfot says, and you've accomplished Hashavah with the other two items, that still with that third item, you have to return it. So now the Gemara says, "Vay Rava, gazal shtei agudot bepruta." He stole two items that are worth a pruta together. Ve'chzir lo achat mehen, and then he returns one of the two items. Mahu? What do we do with this situation? Miyam minan hashta leka gezela. Do we say that over here the leka gezela gabe? Since there's no gezela with him, so he doesn't have to return it, because whatever he has left is worth less than a shavet pruta. Odelma ha lo hadar gzela, davi gabe. Or maybe we say he never returned that which he had, because remember, the thing that item that he returned is also worth less than a shavet pruta, so he hasn't accomplished the mitzvah of hashava. Hadar pashto, he answered, gzela inkan, hashava inkan. There's no theft here, and there is no hashava, there's no return here. I mean, both items fail. The item that he still has in hand is not gzela because it's less than a shavet pruta. The item that he returned is also not a shavah because it was less than a shavet pruta. Igzela inkan hashavah yeshkan. Gemara says, wait a minute, if he doesn't have any theft here, then he's accomplished the return of the item. The two are mutually exclusive. Either you return the item and therefore you have no gzela, or you haven't returned the item and that's why you have gzela. How can you say both are true? That you both didn't return the item, but you're also not holding the gzela. So hachi kamar. Afopish gzela enkan, even though the gzela is not in his hand anymore, because it's less than a shavet pruta, mitzvah hashava enkan. He also has not accomplished the mitzvah of hashava. Or in essence, what Rava is saying here in the end is that you can separate between the hashava and the gzela. It's not that the terms are mutually exclusive, and therefore only if you have accomplished hashava are you no longer in possession of Gzeilah, or if you're in possession of Gzeilah, you have not accomplished Hashavah, but we can look at each din independently. You could not be in possession of the Gzeilah, but yet also not accomplish the din of Hashavah. So we can bifurcate or split the din between the Gzeilah, or the din of the Gzeilah, and the din of the Hashavah. And therefore in this case, you don't have any more Gzeilah in your possession, but on the other hand, you still have not accomplished the mitzvah of Hashavah. So now, what that means in terms of Hashavah Enkan, Tosafot Zir, it says, V'nira, to lo by the mifshat, elo de lo ma'akev mitzvah Hashavah. That what he's trying to say here is that it's not ma'akev the mitzvah of Hashavah. Now, he didn't accomplish the mitzvah of Hashavah, because what he returned was less than Hashavah Prutah. But this item itself will also not be ma'akev the mitzvah of Hashavah. That means, or similarly from what Tosafot says is over here, is that there's still a reason to return it, even though you might not be chayav to return it. Because it's less than a Hashavah Prutah, you have no obligation to return it, and it's not ma'akev, the mitzvah of Hashavah. But if you did return it, that would, number one, be the proper thing to do, and you might accomplish the mitzvah of Hashavah, you might not have an obligation to do so, but it would accomplish the mitzvah of Hashavah. There are other Rishonim who say, when we say that mitzvah of Hashavah ain't gone, is that you're mufka from the mitzvah of Hashavah. You cannot, or you can no longer, accomplish the mitzvah of Hashavah. I mean, that's, you've created a situation or circumstance by which you have, you've been forced into a position where you can't accomplish Hashavah. So here when we say Hashavah ain't gone, you can either read that as being there's no obligation to do Hashavah. It's not an akev, but you could do it and you would accomplish it. Or it means literally that you can no longer accomplish that mitzvah of Hashavah. And we'll see now from the next case that that seems more likely the explanation, even though the Rishonim don't gravitate towards that explanation. From the next case, it seems more like that you're mufka from this din. Because Amar Rava, Hari Amru, Nazir Shigileach, V'she'er Shtei Sarot. And Nazir shaved his head, but left over two hairs. Lo asav, lo klum, he did not accomplish Giluach, because the remaining two hairs mean that you didn't shave off. Two hairs are the minimum amount, both for shaving, as well as the minimum amount to say that you didn't shave. So when he shaved his head and left two hairs left, he didn't shave his head. Boy Rava, Gileach Achat, V'nashra Achat Mahu. If he then shaves off one of them, and the last one falls off, what is the din? Because in order to accomplish the giluach, he really needs to shave off the remaining two. Here he only shaved off one. By the time he did that, the second one fell off. So I'm Rav Acha midifti Ravina Nazir shigileach achat achat kami baile the Rova. Rova's question doesn't seem to be so outstanding, because all he's saying is you went ahead and you shaved your head one hair at a time. So he went one second hair, third hair, fourth hair. Of course, in that case, or that scenario, if you get to the point where there aren't two hairs left, you've accomplished the mitzvah of giluach. So over here, he shaved his whole head, left two hairs, and he just shaves one more hair. All he's doing is just continuing the process of shaving. Of course, he should be yotze in that case. So I'm lo tzricha, no. The order here is wrong. The case is, kagon shenashara chat mehem, bigileach achat. It was in the other way around, which is that he shaves the whole head, leaves two hairs over. Then one hair falls out. And now he's only left with one hair. And he shaves that remaining one hair. Do we say that right now he shaved his head, and what remains is nothing less than two hairs, and therefore it wasn't an issue? Oh, Dilma, halav giluachu. This isn't a guach at all. To me, kara shir shtei sarot. In the beginning, when he first shaved his head, he left over two hairs, so he never accomplished giluach. V'ashta ki gileach lo avi beit sarot. And now, when he tries to accomplish the mitzvah of giluach, he didn't shave two hairs, because one of them fell out already, and he only shaved the remaining one hair. So that would mean, hadar pashta, se'ar inkan, there's no hair here, giluach inkan, so there's no shaving. Mar says again, isear inkan, giluach ishkan. These are mutually exclusive principles. If there is no hair here, then you've accomplished the giluach. If there is hair here, then you haven't accomplished the giluach. How can you have both statements be true? Hachi kamar, afo pisha se'ar inkan, even though there's no hair here, mitzvat giluach inkan, you have not accomplished the mitzvah of giluach. Because in the first shaving, you left over two hairs, so that's not considered shaving. In the latter shaving, you only shaved one hair because one fell out before you got to it, so then you only shaved one hair. That's not called shaving. Shaving is a minimum of two hairs. And so for that reason, you haven't accomplished the mitzvah of giluach. But on the other hand, there's not enough hair here to accomplish the mitzvah of giluach. So you have no hair, and you also don't have a mitzvah of giluach in your hand. Now that has a nafkamina, according to the one who says that giluach is ma'akev. The one who says that giluach is ma'akev, your ability to terminate your nizirut, this would prevent you from terminating your nizirut. You have to wait for your hair to grow back and do another giluach in order to end your nizirut. Or, you have to say, even according to the man d'amar, that giluach is not ma'akev, then over here you were not accomplished, or you did not accomplish the mitzvah of giluach. And so from this case, it seems like, from the proof that Rabbi brought, that when you say you didn't accomplish the mitzvah of giluach, that means that not only did you not accomplish it, but you can't accomplish it, because whatever you have left here is not giluach. You have to wait for the hair to grow back and reset, and then you can accomplish the mitzvah of giluach. But in the current circumstances, you cannot accomplish the mitzvah of giluach, and it's as if there's no opportunity, or it's impossible for you to accomplish it. Later on, you might be able to accomplish it. That's why I said it seems to favor the opinion that when we say that mitzvah hashava einkan, means that you don't have the ability to accomplish the mitzvah hashava, similar to here by Nazir, where you don't have the ability to accomplish the mitzvah giluach. Again, even though later on, once the hair grows back sufficiently, you can accomplish the mitzvah giluach, that already seems to be a reset, a new opportunity, not the old opportunity. And so therefore, it seems like then by hashava, it would say the same thing, that you cannot accomplish hashava anymore. Right now, the Gemara says, "Vamarava hari amru." Here's a third case: chavit shenikva. You have a barrel pitcher that has a hole in it. Visatmoa shmarim hitzilua. If the sediment at the bottom of the barrel plugs the hole, it saves it. So now, what the scenario here is? Machloket Rashi in the Tosafot. Rashi says the scenario here is where you have a house that has a sunlight in it, and their day of sunlight meant a hole in the roof, but it goes up to an upper area, an aliyah that is above. So you have an opening in the ceiling that allows you to access the aliyah. If you have tumah down below in the house below, you have a cadaver that is there, a mate that is there, the tumah spreads throughout the house and then goes up into the aliyah. As long as the opening between the house and the aliyah, the upper levels, is at least a tefach by a tefach, then the tumah would also go up to the upstairs. If you plugged that hole, and by plugging that hole, you make the area less than a tefach by a tefach, then the tumah would not pass to the upper area. Now, the only way you can plug the hole is if you use an item that is not mekabel tumah, or an item that is defined as a kli. So a kli cheres is the classic item that we would use, because the kli cheres is not mekabel tumah from the outside. It's only mekabel tumah from the inside. So if you have a kli cheres that is sitting in this hole, or this opening in the ceiling, it will plug the opening, and therefore not allow the tumah to go from the lower level to the upper level. But that all assumes, number one, that the utensil that there is a utensil. That's number one. And number two is that it cannot be mikabel tumah from the tumah below. If it has a hole in it, both of those issues might become a problematic. If it has a hole in it, it may no longer be a kli, depending on the size of the hole. If it has a hole in it, it might also allow the tumah to enter into the kli. So for that reason, we don't want there to be a hole in the kli, because then it loses its preventative qualities from blocking the tumah from rising from the lower level to the upper level. So what happened here is there's a hole in there, which would ruin it as a kli, but the hole got stuffed by the sediment. You didn't plug it. The hole was just covered up by the sediment, so it's still functioning as a kli. But the only reason it's functioning as a kli is because the sediment settled into the hole. There we say, in the Mishnah in Kelim, that is good enough to make it into a kli, or prevent the tumah from going up to the upper level. That's Rashi's view. The Bali et Tosafot say that that's found in later Prakim in Kelim, and this Perek in Kelim is speaking about the issue of Tzamid Patil. Tzamid Patil is that when you have a kli cheres inside of a house that has tumah, an ola tumah, meaning that there's a mate in the house, then any kli cheres that is in there that is completely sealed, meaning that, again, kli cheres does not get tumah from the outside. If it's covered and sealed, then the tumah cannot enter the kli cheres. The kli cheres will remain tahor. That means anything inside of it is also protected from the tumah to ol. If you break the seal on top, or the kli has a hole in it, and it no longer has the shem kli to it, then it can no longer protect the items that are inside of it, because it is mekabel tuma. If it's mekabel tuma, it can't protect the items inside of it. So that's what Tosafot says the case is here. It was a kli cheres in the house that is sealed on top, and then all of a sudden it gets a hole in it. So now it won't protect the items inside of it. But then it got plugged by the shmarim, by the sediment, and therefore now it remains protective in nature, and everything inside of it will not be mekabel tuma. So that is the scenario. Then Rova's question is, by Rova, agaf chetzia mahu. Instead of the sediment plugging the hole, he goes ahead and plasters half the hole. So the hole exists, and then he plasters half the hole. Here the question is that sufficient to be considered that the hole is plugged at this point in time? So for Rashi, that means, is that sufficiently plugged so it doesn't allow the tuma to rise to the upper level because there's a kli blocking the hole in the ceiling? Or for Tosafot, does it mean that this kli is protective inside all our mate? Is it sufficiently now protective because you lowered the hole below the threshold by which it would ruin the kli? So generally, the hole that you need is bekones mashke, the ability to allow liquids into the kli. That generally is a hole that will allow the tuma to enter into the kli. For certain types of kelim, if you utilize them for certain items, the need for the hole to be bigger, depending on what item you store in there, might have impact on here in terms of ruining it from being a kli. Because as long as it can still accomplish the purpose it had before, it retains its status as a kli. So even though as a hole, it might still have a status of a kli. Generally, the principle is kones mashke, the ability for liquids to get in. So now when he plugs off half of it, the hole is still there, but it's partially plugged. So that's the question. Is that partial plug sufficient to ruin or take away the hole? So therefore, you don't have a problem. Or the fact that he only plugged half of it means that the hole is really still there, just with something in the way, which is you have a half of a plug there. Tosafot goes as far to say he's not even sure what the question is. The din is that you need a hole this big for tuma to go in. If you plug half of it, the hole isn't that big. So why is there even a question? That's what Tosafot says. He's not sure why this is even an issue. So what you have to say is something along the lines of, since it's only temporary, or the plug is not permanent because you only put half a plug in there, and it's going to allow liquids to leak or leach in the other half, maybe the half that you plugged is not considered to be a plug because it doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't take away the hole, because the hole still has the problem. It may not be the minimum shiur, but maybe the fact that you only sealed half means that the part that you did seal is not even considered sealed. And that must be the nature of the question of Rava. So Amalei Rav Yemer the Ravashi, Lav Mishnatenu Hizo. Isn't that our Mishnah? That's not. Chavit Shenigva V'Satmu Hashmarim Hitzilua. If you have a chavit that has a hole in it, and then the sediment plugs it, it saves it. Paka kab bizmora, if he on the land plugged it with a branch or a twig, adshi mareach, until he plasters around it, it doesn't accomplish what you need. Hayubash daim, if he had two branches or twigs in there plugging the hole, adshi mareach min atzadim, ubenzmora lechaverta, then he has to put in plaster both around the twigs and in between the twigs. Taima de Mireach. Only because he plastered it is it considered a seal. Hallo Mireach. If he did not plaster it, lo, then it's not considered a seal. Amai. Why isn't that the case? Mitavi ki egaf chetzia. Why isn't it the same as him plastering half the hole? Meaning that when you put the twigs in, they cover half the hole. So the plaster only solves the problem for the remainder. So why isn't this the exact same case of rubble? And we see it fails unless you plaster around it and you seal it entirely. So Amrei, wait a minute, those two cases, Achi Ashto, you can't compare these cases. Hotam ilo mereach lo kai egef. Over there, if you don't plaster it, the twigs are not going to stay in the hole. When you plug the hole with the twigs or the piece of wood that you put in there, it's not going to stay in place unless you plaster it. Therefore, it's not considered a plug because it'll just slip out, it'll come out. Egef chetzia, on the other hand, he plugs half of it. Whatever he plugged is plugged. It's not coming out. It's plastered. It's sealed. So yes, the other half is still there, but at least what he put in will stay. So you can't prove anything from the Mishnah over there, because the Mishnah over there is talking about items that are not going to stay in there without plastering. That's why you must plaster them. Over here, where you use plaster to seal that half is not going anywhere. So that's the nature of Rava's question, and that's not answered by the Mishnah. So we don't resolve this issue over here. That's number one. And number two, as Tosafot points out, that this, in the series of questions over here, this question that we just went through is a little different than the other questions. In the other questions, you're going below a threshold, and then you have a mitzvah that you could have accomplished, and it's ruined by that. And the fact that you can't accomplish it now because you're below that threshold. Over here, we don't have that type of item. You're talking about a threshold or a shiur, and then you are blocking out part of that shiur. But over there, we're not talking about a mitzvah. We're not talking about accomplishing something. We're simply wondering if taking out half the item then brings it below the threshold amount. So it's similar in, we'll call it the wording to the other questions, but in a genre, it's not the same type of question as we mentioned before. So now we move on to another statement of Rava. Amar Rava, Hari Amru, Gazal Chametz V'Arelav Al Pesach. Stole Chametz and Pesach passes. Aumer Lo Arei Shalcha Lefanecha. Then he says, here's your Chametz, take it. By Rava, Nishba Alav Mahu. What happens if he takes a Shvuah denying the fact that he has the Chametz, or denying the fact that he owes the Chametz? If this chametz is stolen from him at this point, then b'mamona kekafrele. When he denies it, he's denying a monetary item. Even though the chametz itself inherently is worthless, it went through Pesach, it's now worthless. So when he takes a shvuah about a worthless item, he's not really denying any monetary item. It itself is not inherently money. Or do we say, because this chametz protects or prevents the gazlan from having to make monetary compensation, it's the equivalent of denying money. Because if this chametz gets stolen or lost at this point, he will have to make monetary compensation. Therefore, when he denies it, it's equivalent of denying monetary compensation. Or do we say now it's worthless? It's a bunch of dust sitting here. And since it is here, he doesn't have to make monetary compensation. And therefore, there's no money that he is denying at this point. And so there he won't be chayav for this shvuah that he takes falsely, denying the owing of this money or this item. I mean that, in terms of the shvuah itself, it might be a shvuah shav or a shvuah bitoy, which will be chayav for. But as far as the obligation to make compensation of a karen and a chomesh and a sham gzelot, that's the question here, whether it's under that category. Has he denied a monetary obligation or not? So milta di baile the rava, that which was a question for rava, pshitale the rabba, is simple to rabba. The amar rabba, shori ganafta, you stole my shor. Vehu amer, lo ganafti, I did not steal it. Mativo etzlecha, what is it doing with you? Why do you have this shor? How did you get your hands on this shor? Shomer chinam ani alav. He says, I was a shomer chinam. You deposited with me and I'm a shomer chinam. Chayav. He is chayav in that case. Shari patar atzmo migneva ve'aveda. Because by making that claim, he actually improved his situation. I'll explain it in a second. We'll go through all the items and explain it. Shomer sachar ani alav. Or he makes a claim, it's in my possession because you made me into a shomer sachar. Chayav, again he's chayav there for this shvu'ah. Shari patar atzmo mishvura umeita. Because then he is patur for it dying or any ones that happens. Shu'el ani alav. I am a shu'el. You lent it to me. That's why I have it in hand. Chayav, again you're chayav. Harei patar atzmo mimeita machmat malacha. Because there you also got yourself an out, which is that you won't be responsible for it if it dies while it is working. So what this statement says, according to Rabbo, is when a person steals a shor, he's a gazlan. A gazlan is chayav in al onsim. He's fully responsible for the item. There are no exemptions for a gazlan. No matter what happens, ones, no ones, does not matter. He has no exemptions, on the hook for everything. So then the owner comes along and says, give me back my item. But then he says to him, why is it with you? He says, I'll tell you why it's with me. I'm a shomer chinam. I'm a shomer sachar. I'm a shoel. So in explaining that that is the case, he's agreeing that this item belongs to the Baalim. When he agrees that this item belongs to the Baalim, it takes a shvu'ah to that effect, that I am a shomer chinam, I am a shoel, I am a shomer sachar, then why should he be chayab in that point? He's agreeing that this item belongs to the other individual. So what Rabba says is that he changed his liability. By taking the shvu'ah, The nature of the liability which he has changed. If he was a gazlan, he'd be chayav for everything. Shomer chinam, all of a sudden he's patur from geneva and aveda. So therefore it was stolen or it was lost at that point, he would be off the hook because he makes a claim of shomer chinam. That is a monetary denial despite the fact that it has not happened yet. It wasn't stolen yet. It wasn't taken yet. But the fact that you've now set up a circumstance in which you would have more rights or more protection, that is deemed as if you were denying a monetary claim. And similarly by a shomer sachar and a shoel. Since in each of those cases you have an exemption from having to repay the item to the original owner, even though it doesn't come to fruition, the fact that you gained yourself that right means that is a monetary item and a monetary denial. If you take a shvuah to that effect, it is a shvuah sheker that will garner a, if you admit that you lied, a requirement to pay Karen B'chomesh and the Asham Gzelot. So you see from that, Alma, Afagav Da'al Koyim, even though the item is still extant, sitting in your hands now, Kevan Di Mignav Mamona Kakafar, if it was stolen, he would be making a monetary denial. Hashtanami Mamona Kakafar. So too now, it's considered as if he's making a monetary denial now, even though in the current state, there is no denial. Hochanami, that would be the same thing by Chametz. Avagav the Afra Ba'amahu, even though right now in its current state, it is worthless. It has no monetary value. Kevin de Mignav by Shlumele, if it was stolen in the future, you would have to pay for it. Mamona Ma'alya. Therefore, it is considered to be full-fledged mamon. Hashtanami mamona kakofale. And therefore, tier two, if he takes a shwa to that effect, denying the fact that he has the chametz, it's the equivalent of denying a monetary obligation, and he would be chayav for that. So Rava clearly believes when you make a denial, but denial changes your liability in some way. Even though at this point in time, whatever you've done has no monetary impact, but in the future it could have monetary impact or it could protect you monetarily, that's enough to be considered money today or a denial of money today, and you'll be on the hook for a korban, Hashem gzelot, and for the Karen V'chomesh if you admit to your wrongdoing. For Rava, that is a question. Rava queried about this, and he wasn't as certain as Rava as to the outcome or the perspective that Rava had over here. Yotiv Rava, v'kamar l'hashmaitita. So that's the gears that the Bach brings. Our Gemara is the gears of Yotiv Rava, v'kamar l'hashmaitita. He said this over. Eitvei Rav Amram l'Rava. So then Rav Amram asks Rava, or if you have the other gears, it's Eitvei Rav Amram l'Rava. V'kichesh ba, it says in the pasuk that he denies owing the money. Prat l'modeh b'ikar. That's the exclusion of someone who agrees to the principal with an A, that the principal amount, the balim own it. Ketzad, what's an example of that? Shari ganavta, t'bomer lo ganavti. He says, I didn't steal it. Mativo etzlecha, what do you have it for? Ata machartoli, you sold it to me. You gave me as a gift. Avicha machroli. Your father sold it to me. Avicha netanoli. Your father gave me as a gift. Your question is a good question because over here in all these cases, he is denying the ownership of the other party. He's not agreeing that the other guy owns it. The Gemara will come back and ask, what are the scenarios here where he's not denying the other ownership? Achar parati rats. It was chasing my para. It just was being friendly and it chased my para and ended up in my yard. May Allah by its leaf. It decided to walk over here by itself. That's what it's doing in my yard. To'eb derech. Mitzativ. Got lost and came over here. And I found it. Shomer chinam ani alav. I'm a shomer chinam. Shomer sachar ani alav. Shuel ani alav. I'm one of the shomrim. Vinishba. And he takes the shua to that effect. Vihodeh. And then he admits to it afterwards. Yochol yei chayav. You think he'd be chayav in these cases? Tamalomar v'kichesh ba. That he denied it. Prat l'modeh b'ikar. To the exclusion of the case where he agrees that the principal is owned by the owner. In all these scenarios, we'll see in a second why that's true in all these scenarios, but at least in the latter scenarios, it's clear that he agrees that he doesn't own the item. He simply says, it walked into my yard, it was chasing my cow, I found it. All of those don't deny the ownership of the real owner. All they do is what Rava said before, is that they reduce his liability. He's a gazlan, he's going to be on the hook for everything. If he's a shomer, a shoel, a shomer sachar, he has exemptions in certain circumstances for having to make payment. And the Braita here says, you're not subject to the rules of a shvuat sheker denying money because you agreed that it was owned by the owner. That would go against what Rabbah said. The Brayta is explicit. In a case where you declare yourself a shomer and denying the fact that you stole it, even though you're lying, in that case, if you take a shvuat, that shvuat will not land you in having to pay a keren v'chomesh and a nasham gzilot. That's against Rabbah's position. Samalei, tadura, seems to be some sort of slight to Rav Amram, which is, as Rashi says over here, ein lecha leif, you have no heart. Others say that the word here is tarda, mishul meim. Rashi in other places translates it as shoteh, you fool. Basically, he's saying to him, you're asking me a question, but the question isn't a question. You're asking a silly question because you didn't think through the case, which is, kitanya ahi, that case is the kamalei helech. He says to me, here it is, take it. Kikamina, what I'm talking about is the kaim of agam, where it's not in his possession currently, it's out in the agam. So therefore, in that case, you can't say helach. So in the case of the braita, where he agrees to the principal ownership of the original owner, and he somehow is denying his full liability here as a gazlan, but the animal's right here, and he says, helach, take it, it's yours, take it, go ahead. In that case, even if he takes a shvat sheker, he's not going to be on the hook. The question is, or the way that Rabbah says it, is when it's out in the agam, out in the swamps, out in the fields, then when he makes such a denial, then it has monetary impact, because he's changed his liability vis-a-vis the animal, because the animal's not in the hands of the balim, it's not given back to the hands of the balim. So in that instance, then I believe my din is true, which is that his denial of liability, even though nothing's gone wrong yet, gains him money, or the equivalent of monetary value, and if he denies it and takes a shvua, he'll be subject to keren v'chomesh and asham gzelot. Now the Gemara asks the question on the Braita. It says, "Atam mecharatoli, you sold it to me. My moda b'ika ika." What exactly is the admission that he owns it? Meaning that if he says, you sold it to me, that means you no longer own it. I own it. That's not an agreement to the fact that the item is owned by the previous owner. When it says, lo, tzrikha d'amalei, lo natate lecha d'me, shakol torcha v'zil. He says, listen, I didn't pay you for it. You sold it to me. I didn't pay for it. Take your item back. I'm not going to pay for it. I don't have the money for it. Take it back. So he's returning the item. So he says, you sold it to me, but I never paid for it. Now you can take your item back. Ata netatoli, avicha netanoli. You gave it to me. Your father gave it to me. My moda b'ikar ikar. Again here, what's the admission that the original owner still owns it? Damarlei, amnat davidna lecha nayach denafsho. It's on a condition that I do something nice for you. I do you a favor. I make you happy. Falo avdi lecha. And I didn't do it. I wasn't successful, or I didn't try yet to do something for you. Shakil torcha bezil. Take your animal and go back, because I didn't accomplish the condition in the sale. I found it wandering around. So then why doesn't the owner say, Lema yibayla chale indurili? You should have returned it to me. You knew I was the owner of this animal. Why didn't you do a Shabbat Aveda? And the Rashba says here, don't conclude from here that there's an obligation for the person who finds the Aveda to search for the Bala Veda. He might have to make it known that he has it, but the real obligation is on the Bala Veda to search it out. And what happened here is the Bala Veda was looking around for it, and this person didn't say that he had it. So that was his failure over here. Not that he didn't return it or give it back to the item, but he knew someone was looking for this item, and he never speaks up or indicates the fact that he's holding on to an item that matches the description of the Bala Veda. So I'm going to go to Omer, Shvua, Aveda, Matzati, V'lo Ayiti Yodea, Shishalcha, Shech Zerena Lecha. Says, it took a Shvua that I found it as an Aveda, as a lost item, and I didn't know it was yours to return it to you. So yes, I found it as an Aveda, but no, I didn't know it was yours. Now, even though truthfully, he really stole it. He was a gazlan and he stole it. Over here, he makes a denial of the fact that he stole it by saying it was an Aveda, and an Aveda that I found and I had no idea who the owner was. So that's how he tries to get himself off the hook. Again, there, if he admits to lying here, he doesn't have to pay a keren chomesh and Hashem gzelot, because he agrees in principle that the item belongs to the original owner. He's not denying the ownership of the original owner, and therefore he's not subject to v'kicheish ba. So Tanya, Amar ben Azai, Gimel Shvuot Hein. They are three different types of shvua. Hikir ba velo b'motza. He knows the item, but not the one who found it. B'motza velo ba. He knows who found it, but he didn't know what they found. Lo bava lo b'motzai. He doesn't know the item, and he didn't know who found it. So over here, the way Rashi explains the cases here are cases of an eid echad. An eid echad is taking a shvuah about what he saw. The owner of the item is coming to this eid echad and says, come to testify for me in court. And he takes a shvuah, denying the fact that he has any evidence. So then the Gemara says, v'lo bava lo b'motzai, kushta ishtaba. If he doesn't know who the person was and what the aveda was, then he's telling the truth. He didn't say anything wrong. Why should he be chayav? So ema ba uber motza. He knew the person and the aveda. The Gemara says, the mai hilchata. Then what is the locha ramifications of this shvuah over here? So this, again, a case according to Rashi is mashbia eid echad, forcing an eid echad to take a shvuah about the information that he has or that which he witnessed. So Gemara says, mai hilchata rabbi ami amar rabbi chanan liftor, that the din here comes to teach you that you are patur mikurban shvuat ha'idut. That if this person denies knowing any edut over here, then he's patur from a karban shvuat edut, because even if he had testified, he could not obligate the other party, because when you only have one aid, you can't obligate monetary compensation, you can only obligate a shvuah. And who knows whether the guy would have taken the shvuah or not taken the shvuah. Maybe he would have taken the shvuah and lied, and therefore you can't deem him to be someone who denied testimony where he had testimony that would change the outcome of the case. Since he's an eid echad, his testimony won't necessarily change the outcome of the case. It can have influence on the case, but it may not change the outcome of the case. If you're two edim, it's clear there that you will change the outcome of the case, because your testimony will force the individual to have to pay back the item because of their testimony. So when you deny a dut in that case, then there is no question you have to bring a kurban shvat a dut. On the other hand, if you took the shvuah as an eid echad, denying that you had edut, in each of these cases, your edut, even if you testified, wouldn't necessarily close the case. It would just force the other party to take a shvuah. If the other party takes the shvuah, he could lie or not lie. We don't know what the outcome of that situation would be. And therefore, it's not as if, for sure, you would have changed the outcome of the case. On the other hand, Shmuel amar lechiyuv. Shmuel says, no. It means that you are chayav for shvuat heidut. Uplukta da'ani tanae. And it's similar to a machloka tanaim that we have over here, the Tanya. A mashbia eid achad patur. Person who forces an eid achad to take a shvuat heidut, denying the fact that he has any testimony, in truth he does have testimony, he is patur. Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon, michayev. B'maika miflegei, what's their machloket? Mar savar davara gorim le mamon, ki mamon dami. Rabbi Shimon Elazar believes that something that can cause money or monetary outcome is the equivalent of money. And therefore, since you have the ability to cause a situation in which the person has to take his shvuah, and that shvuah could generate a monetary outcome, that's goreim lemamon. Your testimony would have been goreim lemamon. And since goreim lemamon is kemamon dami, when you take the shvuat eidut, you had monetary impact on the case, and now you are chayav for shvuat eidut. Marsav lav kemamon dami, it's not like money, and therefore you wouldn't have had monetary impact on the case, and if you denied having testimony, that denial will not make you chayab for shvuat eidut. Now, in terms of the three cases here, the Rishonim discuss which of the three cases are applicable here. According to Rashi, all three cases are in this category of eid echad, and then the question revolves around what's the nafkamina that he knows this testimony. Does it have any impact? The answer is yes, because he's an eid echad in a case, and he knows this information, and when he takes a shvuah, denying the fact that he knows this information, is he then subject to shvuat eidut? Because what would that have information done had he come to court with that information? And again, in all those cases, it would have precipitated a shvuah by the other party, and therefore, according to that, you would have been in denial of testimony that you had, and if that has monetary worth, then you are subject to shvuat ha'edut. So that's the way that Rashi learns it. There are Rishonim that say that if all three cases are be'ed achad, the first two cases are clearly not chayav and shvuat ha'edut, because he has both half a testimony, and his testimony would only have possibly generated a shvuah. And the last case where he's an eid achad and will definitely generate a shvuah, that's the case of goreim lemamon, and that's what the Gemara is asking about, the mai hilchata, what's the halachic ramification of that last case. The first two cases are obvious that you are patur. It's really only the third case where we don't know, where he knows full testimony. He knows who the finder was and which the Aveda belonged to. And the other two pieces of testimony, he only knows either the finder or the object. He doesn't know the other information. So over there, he wouldn't have had impact on the case. And therefore, the Gemara is not asking what the nafkamina is those cases. In those cases, it's clear that that testimony has no bearing, because that's a dovara goreim the goreim. It's a goreim to a goreim, because it's not even certain that his testimony will do anything, because he only has partial information. Whereas by the latter case, which is the case where he knew both pieces of information, there he could have swayed the case, and then that's subject to this machloket here, as to whether you're chayav in shvuat eidut or not in that instance. There are those that suggest that the first two cases are talking about two eidim, and only the last case is talking about an eid echad. First two cases, we have Shnei Edim, even that testimony itself is a Goreim L'Mamon, because they only have half of a testimony. They don't have the complete picture. And so they're only with the Tziruf of another party, would you have a full testimony. And that is also a Goreim L'Mamon. So the first two cases are a case of two Edim. And the latter case is a case of one Eid, where he has all the information, but he's only an Eid Echad that can be Mechayev Eshua, not be Mechayev Mamon. So again, you have different permutations within the Rishonim as to which of these cases we're speaking about, and what exactly is the scenario in these cases. How many Edim do you have here? But in the end, the question revolves around this idea where you do not have direct impact on the case, because you can only precipitate a Shavua in the case. So as you precipitate a Shavua in the case, it's not certain that that Shavua will get the outcome where the individual will be chayav or will tell the truth. And so because of that, you're only at davar ha-goreim l'mamon. Is that enough to mechayev you in shvuat ha-idut? That will depend on whether you think davar ha-goreim l'mamon is kimamon dummy or not kimamon dummy. That's a good question. In general, is there an obligation to testify? Meaning that Mishonim argue about what exactly is the obligation here. Is there only a problem if you take a Shavua denying the fact that you have testimony? That's the only time that there's a problem. But otherwise, there's no independent obligation to testify. Whereas there are Rishonim, and we'll get this in the Gemara in Shavuot, that there are those that believe that there's an underlying obligation to testify. And that's when you put the Shavua together with it, that's what puts you into a bad position, because the Shavua enhances or makes the severity of your denial much greater. But independent of the Shavua, there is an obligation to testify. So that is a machloket in the Rishonim as to whether there's an underlying obligation to testify. But clearly, if you take a Shavua denying the fact that you have testimony, that's a problem according to everyone. The only question is, did you have testimony that would have made a difference? That's the key element here, and that's what we're discussing here, whether he has sufficient testimony to make a difference. That depends on what you think the value of his testimony is in engendering a Shavua by the counterparty. Amar Rav Sheshet, a kofer bepikadon, someone who denies having a pikadon, naselav gazlan, you become a thief right away, v'chayav be'onsin. So the way that Rav Sheshet phrases this is, as soon as someone comes to you and says, can I have back my deposit? Says, I don't have your deposit, you never gave me a deposit. So he's denied the fact that he has the item with him. Right away you become a gazlan, because you deny the fact that you have it. You don't have to take a shvua to become a gazlan and chayav be'onsin. Simply a verbal denial of the fact that you have it suffices to make you into a gazlan, and right away you're chayav be'onsin. Batani tuna, and we have a mishnah that tells the following. The truth is, it's not a mishnah, but it's a braita. So this is a stranger usage of the term tani tuna. Tani tuna really means that it's a tana that we're familiar with. Familiar with means because it's in a mishnah and everybody's familiar with mishnayot. Here the Gemara uses the term tani tuna by a braita, which not everybody would be familiar with. So somewhat of a question as to why the Gemara uses that terminology over here. Elim Yukain, you say that this was a type of braita that was well known, or this braita was on the level of a mishnah because it was so widely known, but something along those lines. Tani tuna, kichesh ba, that he denied it. Lamadnu onish, from there we learn that you get punished. Azara minayin, where do we know the fact that there is a warning? Tamad Omar, lo techachashu, that you may not deny things. So, in the Sefer Vayikra, when it says there, lo techachashu, that is in a context of making denials of money that you owe, or situations where you owe money. And it says there, lo techachashu, that one may not deny that which they owe. They may not lie about it. And therefore, if he does lie about it, he's on the hook. my love, the onish mamon, isn't that for what seems to be the monetary punishment over here? This brayta would be a proof to what Rav Sheshet says. The havamina here that we're talking about mamon means that it's like what Rav Sheshet says, that the simple denial of the monetary obligation is sufficient to generate the obligations over here, to make you chayav on sin, to be deemed a gazlan, and you don't need a shvuah. So what it sounds like from this case here is, isn't this the trigger for the onish mamon, the monetary punishment? The monetary punishment over there would be the requirement to repay the item and be on the hook for the onsin. Because as the Bali Tosafot note over here, he says, Tema, b'mamon, my sheikh lamar, lo anash, elimkin, he's here. How can you say that the Torah doesn't punish unless you warned? Meaning that mamon doesn't need a warning. When we talk about a warning and a punishment, that talks about something that tells you what the punishment for what you're doing is. And then you need a lav to say you don't do this. In terms of money or monetary payments or compensation, the Torah just tells you you are chayav. You don't need a punishment and a warning. It just tells you, if you do this, this is what you're going to be chayav, or this is what you are responsible for. Therefore, it seems that if you're talking about the punishment of a korban, that makes more sense. So the onish mamon might mean that it precipitates the asham gzelot, and that's what it's talking about here, and not the monetary compensation of a Karen v'chomesh, or you have to say that because the return of the money is connected to the korban, therefore we can call it onish and azara over here, because enwrapped in the bringing of the korban is also this obligation to return the money, and so therefore we can speak about money in the terms of onish and azara. Or in the way that we are establishing in the Havamina, it might be the fact that we have to connect between the obligation of a Shivat Gzela Shel Gazal to the Kichesh. That's what's important over here, that just the simple denial without a Shvuah can generate that obligation. Where do we know that? Or where is there a restriction or a law that he's violating that would generate the necessity of a Shivat Gzela Asher Gazal by simple denial? And so that's what we need to find. We need to find the Iser of denial that without a Shvuah would precipitate that outcome. You can see that in the Girsa Rashi where he says, my love, onish kfira, to the onish of denial, not onish mamon. So that's Rashi who thinks that the denial here generates the chiyuv onsin. The Gemara says, no, the onish shvuah. Speaking about a case of a shvuah. Means for the punishment of the shvuah. And again here, when it says onish shvuah, Rashi, l'shitato, says it means you're chayab be'onsin, which is really the question of the Gemara, according to the shita of Rav Sheshet, that you are chayab be'onsin. That's the onish that we're discussing here. And so, therefore, when we said before onish mamon, we meant that just for a simple denial, you would generate a chayab be'onsin. And now when we say no, the inyan shvuah means that only through a shvuah will you generate a chayab be'onsin. Whereas most of the Rishonim say no, that the onish shvuah means that the korban will only be precipitated through a shvuah, whereas in the previous scenario we said that the korban or the monetary obligations could be triggered by a simple denial of owing the money, the kichesh ba. So amiktani seifa, in that bright, in the latter half of the bright, it says the ishtabo, that it was talking about a case of shvua, michal deresha delo ishtaba. Makes it sound like the resha is a case where he didn't take a shvua. Tani seifa, the seifa says, v'nishba al sheker. He took a false shvua. This is on the parshia of the asham gzelot in Vayikrahei. Over there it says that he took a false shvua. L'manu onish. We now know what the punishment for the taking the false shvua is. Zara minayin. How do we know that there's a warning not to take a false shvua? Tamal omar, lo tishakru. That you may not lie. The way that Rashi says it is that is the requirement of lo tishavu'u b'mishmi l'shaker. Don't swear in my name falsely. And then from the pasuk that says lo tishakru ish b'amito, people should not lie to each other. And the word amito is used there. And in our case, v'kichesh b'amito is used. So from there we learn out that the sheker here is a denial to another party. So that's how we know that it's lo tishakru ish b'amito, tells us that the nature of the denial here is a shvuah. And then how do I know that you're not a lie under oath? That's from lo tishavu b'shmi l'shaker. So the juxtaposition of lo tishavu b'shmi l'shaker 2, lo tishakru ish ba'amito, and the amito tells us that what is the scenario that it's speaking about when it says lo tishavu b'shmi l'shaker is a case of amito, a case of denial with a shvua. That's Rashi's view. Others say that the whole lav is learnt out of lo tishavu b'shmi l'shaker. So when it says, the seifa, the ishtaba, it's clear in the seifa, the problem is you took a false shua, resha de lo ishtaba, that the earlier case is a case that he did not take a shvua. If that's the case, that would be a proof to Rav Sheshet's position, because then it would be a simple denial of the money would make you into a chayab be'onsin, and would obligate you over here, not only if you took a shvua. So Gemara says, no. Idivided ishtaba. Both cases in the brighter are a case where he took a shvua. Kansha hodeh, kansha bo'edim. Depends on how he's incriminated in the end. If he admits to lying, then he's going to be chayav a keren, chomesh, and asham gzelot. If a deem come and they say that he did it or that he was really a thief over there, then he's only chayav keren. Because the obligation of keren and chomesh and the asham is only in a case where he's hodeh. That we know from Bamidbar, hey, that has to be that he admitted to his wrongdoing in order to be chayav. Doesn't admit to his wrongdoing, is incriminated by edim, then he has to pay back the money, but he's not subject to the keren v'chomesh and the asham zelot. At edim chayav be'onsin. If edim come, then he's responsible for the onsim. He becomes fully liable. He's a gazlan now. And now he's obligated, until he returns the item, for anything that happens to it. Aduye alodi. If he admits to the fact that he lied, then he's chayab b'kerem v'chomesh v'asham. Responsibilities or the obligations are different depending on how he's incriminated. In both cases, he took a shvua. But the way that we find out that he's a gazlan impacts on what his obligations are. If he took a shvua and then edim come and incriminate him, then he becomes chayab in onsin. On the other hand, if he lies and then he admits to lying, then he's chayab onsin, but chayab keren chomesh and the asham gzeilot. As Tosva points out, the explanation is a little forced, only because if you're talking about the same scenario in both cases after the shvua, then the source for the lav should be the same in both instances. And why is they bright after two different sources? At least if we explained it in the Havamina, the way that it supports Rav Sheshet, at least then you can explain why there's a difference between one case where there is no shvua and a case where there is a shvua. But here we're saying both cases are shvua, you explain to me the difference, but why is there a separate lav in those cases? So now the Gemara says, Meitiv Rami Bar Chama, Usha Kenegdo Chashud Al HaShvua. The person, the opposing party, is not trustworthy with a Shvua. Ketzad, how did he become untrustworthy? Echad Shvuat Eidut, Ve'echad Shvuat HaPikadon. If he denied something falsely in Shvuat Eidut, meaning he took a Shvua that he knew no testimony and he really did, or he took a Shvuat HaPikadon, meaning that he denied having a Pikadon under oath, and he's found out to be lying, v'afilu shvuat shav, or even he takes a shvua that is meaningless, meaning that he, under oath, says something that is totally unnecessary or clearly wrong, and he takes a shvua that affects the shvuat shav. So in the other two cases, we understand why he loses his trustworthiness, is because he lies under oath about monetary matters. So he doesn't worry about God, he doesn't worry about stealing money from people. And a shvuat shav, all he indicates is that he doesn't care about taking a shvua, he doesn't indicate that he's willing to steal money from people. Nevertheless, because he's already shown us that a shvua doesn't mean anything to him, we can't trust him under oath. The whole idea of taking a shvua is that the severity of the shvua will cause the person to tell the truth, as if he is speaking directly to God. If this person is willing to take a shvuat shav, then that shvua, or the institution of shvua, doesn't have that impact on him. And therefore, he would not be trusted in a case where he has to take a shvua. V'imita, and if you are right, Rav Sheshet, b'kfira od ifsile, that it's just the simple denial of having the pikadon that makes him into a chashud al shvua or pasul over here, not the fact that he took a shvua denying it. Because according to you, Rav Sheshet, he becomes a gazlan immediately upon denial. Gazlan is pasul to edut or pasul to take a shvua. So why do I need a shvuat pikadon? Just simply the taking or denying of the pikadon is enough to deem him a gazlan. So Amri, ochamai skinan de koi bagam. to lav kfiru. The truth is that the case here is where he doesn't have it in hand. So it's not a real denial. The sava ishtemitna le adazilna maitina le. And he says, listen, I'm going to buy some time until I bring it back to him. I mean, it's lost or it's somewhere out there. I'm going to return it. And when he denies it over here, he's not denying it because he really stole it. He's denying it because he wants to buy himself more time. So if he wants to buy himself more time, that's fine. We won't say that this guy's not trustworthy. We understand the human psychology here that he was trying to buy time, but to do the right thing, which is to give it back. Then if he takes a shvua to that effect, then already he loses his nemanut because he was willing to lie under oath in order to reinforce protecting himself. That we can't have because that means this person is willing to lie under oath, and that we can't have. We can't trust that person anymore. So the difference between Rav Sheshet's case and the case over here is that in the case of Rav Sheshet, the denial is a case where he had it in hand. He denied it and he really was in his house at that time. We have a deem to testify the fact that when he denied it, it was really in his house. Over there, you can only say the reason he denied it is because he wanted to steal it. Over there, he's a gazlan and he's going to be pasul le'idut, pasul le'shvua, and chayav minun tzin. Now then, if it wasn't in his hand at the time he made the denial, then if Adim tells us it was somewhere else when he made that denial, then we can say he was just trying to slip out of the problem until he buy time to get it back to him. But again, if he takes a shvua to that effect and lies under oath, then he also will be pasul. But then at least the kfira, the denial itself, does not result in the same outcome as what Rav Sheshet says, is because the denial here is just a way to slip out of having to admit right now that he doesn't have it in hand to buy himself time to get it back and bring it back to the rightful owner. Teda that I'm right about this, because Amar Rav Yidi Ba'avin, a kofer b'milve kasher le'edut, one who denies having a loan outstanding, meaning a debtor who denies the fact that he owes the money, he still is kasher le'edut. B'pikadon pasul le'edut. If he denies having a pikadon, then he's pasul le'edut. By a loan, we can understand why he would lie about this or deny it, not because he is a liar, but rather he wants to buy more time in order to pay back the loan. And by the pikadon, where it's in his hand, and it's not his, and he's supposed to return it right away, and he makes a denial, that denial makes him into a gazlan. That's similar to what Rav Sheshet says, where it says, V'amar Ilfa, shvua koneh. But Ilfa says about that, and only the shvua brings it into his hand, or makes him into a gazlan. Shvua yi de kanya, a kafir alo kanya. So again, here it sounds like the shvua is the trigger to make a mechayv bonsin and responsible, but a denial by itself would not be enough. So achanami de kayi be'agam. Once again, over there, it's a case where he is in the agam, where it's not in the hands of the shomer. So he now looks much more like a lover, like a debtor. In case the debtor is trying to buy time, here the shomer is also trying to buy time to get the animal back and give it to the rightful owner. So again, in cases where the denial is explainable, or from a psychology standpoint would be quote-unquote justified because they're trying to buy time. Again, they're lying, and we don't want that, but at least we understand why they might lie, not because they really want to cheat people out of money, not because they would lie under oath, but simply because they're trying to buy time to make the repayment. On the other hand, once you've taken a shvua, that's a false shvua, and then you'd be a gazlan from that moment, or you'd be someone who's not trusted with shvuot anymore. Again, in that case, it's a case where the kfira was done when the pikadon was not in the hands of the shomer. And therefore, it looks like a milveh, it looks like a loan situation where he's trying to buy time. In that case, the denial itself is not enough. Some say, no, that what Ilfa said, that shvua koneh, is not about the case of the denial of having a pikadon, but rather it's kidravuna. Dam ravuna marav. He says, you owe me 100 zuz. He says, you have nothing here. He takes a false shvua that he doesn't owe money. And then Edim come after us and say he really does owe the money and he really has the money. Patur, he doesn't have to pay it back. Shnemar, lakach balam velo yishalem. It says in the Torah that the balim will accept the shvuah from the shomer and the shomer will no longer be on the hook. Kevin shekiblo balim shvuah shuv ein mishalem mamon. Once the balim accept the shvuah, there is no monetary obligation left, even if the shvuah was false. Once the shvuah is taken, that mitigates the obligation over here, and Even though technically the guy really stole it, right? He took it out. The Balim had already been satisfied. They were paid back with a Shvuah. They weren't paid with money, but they were paid back with a Shvuah. Once they accept the Shvuah, that's payment in lieu of the money, and they no longer have a claim against the Gazlan or the person that stole over here. Now, obviously, the person who stole has an obligation to the Shivitim Selasher Gazal, and he took a Shvuah, a Sheker. He has all these other problems that he's got to deal with, but in terms of going to a court to enforce him giving it back, we would no longer force him to give it back because the Balim accepted the Shvuah and they basically closed the case with that. Right, so that's interesting over here. The Shvuah is enforced by the court and the court is the one that makes them take the Shvuah. The Balim's acceptance of the Shvuah is because that's the procedure in the court, that this person has to take a Shvuah. It's not that the Balim are given a choice in the matter. And the acceptance of the Balim is not a literal acceptance, but it is the court protocol, and that is as if he got paid, and that's it. He doesn't have a choice in the matter. Okay, we're going to stop here. 8 lines down on the top of Kuvvav Amud Aleph.